Please turn your Bibles with me over to the book of Acts. The book of Acts, we're going to be in chapter 17. Some of you who left for the summer, we were in Luke when you left. We'll just go backwards and review. No, I'd like to review. We're doing the Luke-Acts sequel. The Luke-Acts sequel is written to one person. By one person. Luke wrote it to a man named Theophilus, who had something to do with the trial of Paul. Because at the end of the book of Acts, there's a guy named Paul in prison in Rome, awaiting for his accusers to come so he can have a trial before Caesar, because he's appealed to the courts in Rome. He's a Roman citizen. We found that out in chapter 16 in Philippi, remember with the Philippian jailer, we found out that Paul was a Roman citizen then. So, we have given Theophilus the background to understand who Jesus is, who Paul is, who are these people that are accusing him. And today we're going to focus a little bit on the accusation, because we're going to hear another sermon from the mouth of Paul. Now, the good news is I get to use my pointer again. We don't have a map this time, but for you out there in the podcast world, we are going to show a picture. It's an artist's rendition of the ancient Acropolis in Athens. Is that beautiful or what? Now, there are remnants of this building, and remnants of this building, and remnants of this building over here. It was unfortunately used as target practice by the Ottomans at one time. But it looked like that. It had looked like that for hundreds of years before Paul shows up. But part of what we're talking about is going to happen on this hill. Acropolis means, of course, an elevated city. Acrophobia. Fear of heights, okay? And Polis is a city, and of course, this is where they built their temples, because they like the concept of the gods looking down on them. So this is a pretty amazing place to go and visit today. It was very impressive when Paul was there at the time. Now, why do you need to know that? Because all of those are temples. Those are temples. What's a temple? A temple is where a deity resides, where you will come into the presence of the deity and offer your sacrifices and make a deal. Yeah, that's really what it comes down to. I'll give you this if you give me that. Right? Now, you need to keep that in mind, because Paul is going to talk about temples in his little sermon here. And I got to remind you, Jesus was tried for speaking against the temple, the one in Jerusalem, not these. Because at this time, there's a very impressive temple in Jerusalem. And he was accused of saying, I'll destroy this temple. And Jesus did, in fact, say the temple was going to be destroyed. Yeah. Yeah. And guess what the charge is against Paul? The charge is he brings a Gentile into the temple and desecrates it. Now, that's what they claim they want to kill him for, but that's not exactly what they want to claim. But that is the charge. It has something to do with temples. Temples. So let's get into Acts chapter 17, and I'll put this down. I won't play with it anymore for a while. Yeah, you're safe. Acts chapter 17. Now remember, what's happened here is he has gone into a new continent. He's now in Europe, and he helped start a church at Philippi. We talked about that. Very, very Roman colony. And he was beaten and run out of Philippi, he and Silas. So he and Silas went down to Thessalonica. And they had Timothy with them at that point too. And Luke stayed at Philippi, our author stayed at Philippi. At Thessalonica, he ran into problems with the Jewish synagogue, and they created a mob and ran him out of Thessalonica. So he and Silas went down to Berea. We talked about the Bereans last week and why there's so many churches named Berea. Berean Baptist, Berean Christian, Berean, because they were of noble character. They studied the scriptures to see if what Paul said was true. A group of people came down from Thessalonica, worked up a mob, and Paul had to leave Thessalonica. But he left Silas and Timothy there. Remember, we have two books in our Bible called 1 and 2 Thessalonians to that church. Now, Paul is headed to Athens, and he is escorted there. It says in verse, boy, there's a small today, 16. When Paul was waiting for them in Athens, he was greatly distressed to see that the city was full of idols. So he reasoned in the synagogue with the Jews, which is his mode of operation, and the God-fearing Greeks, as well as in the marketplace, day by day, with those who happened to be there. A group of Epicurean and Stoic philosophers began to dispute with him, some of them asking, "What is this babbler trying to say?" Others remark, "He seemed to be advocating foreign gods." They said this because Paul was preaching about Jesus and the resurrection. Okay, let's stop there for a second. What do you think of when you think of centers of higher education? Hopefully you think of where you went to college, if you went to college and graduated, right? But you know that probably wasn't the top. You wonder where those professors were trained. And then you kind of go up to, okay, where is the most educated place? Now, I told you, Paul is from Tarsus. He grew up in Tarsus. Tarsus is a center of education. Another great center of education is in Egypt. But the place, the center, is Athens. And I bet Paul always wanted to go there. Always. Because he considered himself as being highly educated, and he was highly educated. So this is like, if you got to, I don't know what comes to mind, Oxford, Cambridge, you know, where were your favorite professors trained? This is like getting a chance to go there, and Paul had high hopes about what he could do there because they were highly educated people. Now the text says, well, first off, he was alone. The people who brought him there left. He sent a message back to him and said, "Hey, you tell Silas and Timothy to get here as soon as they can." And you're not going to know this until next week, but I want to tell you now because I like to spoil things for you. He's running out of money. Yeah. Remember, this thing started in Antioch. And all the money they've been spending for places to stay and eating and for traveling, and how much do they have? Well, he gets to Corinth, and we're going to see that next week, and he's out. He's out. And so he gets on the phone, and he calls him at Antioch and says, "Hey, could you, you know, Venmo me some money? Or could you send it Western Cable or Western Union?" Or I, you know, have any of that stuff, right? When he was out, he was out. So he goes to work. He finds some people, and we'll see this next week, who make tents, and he was trained to make tents, and so he goes to work because he's out of money. What you have here is Paul experiencing a culture shock that he's probably never experienced before. Have you ever had culture shock? Yeah. I mean, sometimes we get it in small ways when we travel, right? But if it's just a week or two, you can get through it. And you find out that, you know, no matter how much you complain, these people aren't going to change. No matter how much you think that you know a better way to do it, they're not going to do it. But true culture shock is when you moved someplace and it just knocks you over. You don't understand. And if you've never experienced it, it's not something to look forward to. I've gone through it a couple times in mission work. And it takes years to figure out that you don't understand what these people think and how they work. You don't understand. And I've given you this example before. You know, when I was in Ghana, this guy told me, he says, yeah, somebody come over here for 2 weeks and write an article about how amazing the culture is and, you know, and how much their spiritual life is amazing and all that. And because they were here for 2 weeks. He says, then if you stay for 2 months, you can't write a book. Maybe you can write an article for a paper about how their spiritual life is and how. You stay for 2 years, maybe you can write a paragraph. Because you don't realize how different it is. Well, Paul has come into this great center of education, of learning, and he is distressed because of idols. What? Has he never seen the slideshows? Oh, wait. He's probably never seen slides. Didn't he get National Geographic? Didn't he know what to play? No. Everywhere he goes, there's an idol. What's an idol? An idol is a representation of a deity. And at that place, you can pay homage. You can bow down. You can do their let's make a deal. And he said they were all over, not just in the temple. They were everywhere. And he is greatly distressed that they are not past that because the Jews have been past it for how long? How long did it take for God to get them past idols? Have you read your Old Testament? They still suffered with that until somewhere in the intertestamental period when they said, okay, we're not going to mess with that anymore. He's distressed. He's alone. He wants Silas and Timothy to come. But he can't stop speaking about Jesus and the resurrection. And that goes over really, really well. No, it doesn't. He gets into some disputes with some philosophers. When was the last time you had a philosophical dispute? Yeah. And there's some philosophers that can't even agree with each other. The Epicureans and the Stoics. And I'm not going to get into what they believe, but it's pretty fascinating. And philosophy and debating philosophy go back hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years here. And it was a source of pride in Athens. And they said, what is this babbler saying? When was the last time somebody accused you of babbling? Yeah. Yeah, the Tower of Babel. Speaking a different language. You know, the Greeks are amazing. They, in their world, there was the Greeks and there were barbarians. You know, in the Jewish world, there was Jews and there were Gentiles. Greeks and barbarians. Somebody who did not speak Greek and they spoke a different language, they were barbarians because it sounded like what they said. Their language was saying bar, 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 bar. That's where the word barbarian comes from. Yeah. But Paul spoke Greek. But he was talking about something that they just couldn't understand. So what they did is they invited him to come to speak at a place called the Areopagus, okay? All right, where do we pick that? Verse 19. He seems to be advocating foreign gods. They said this because Paul was preaching about Jesus and the resurrection. Then they took him and brought him to a meeting of the Areopagus. this group met on that hill that you saw before in the Acropolis. Some of your old translation calls it Mars Hill. And when I was 18, I got to be there, and I got to read this sermon on Mars Hill. I didn't know a whole lot about it then, but I thought it was kind of cool. Okay. Nobody listened to me. Doesn't surprise me. Okay. Where they said to him, "May we know about this new teaching, or what this new teaching is that you're presenting? You are bringing some strange ideas to our ears, and we want to know what they mean." And then in a parenthetical statement, in verse 23, it says, "All the Athenians and the foreigners who lived there spent their time doing nothing but talking about and listening to the latest ideas." That's not a nice thing for Luke to say. Right? You don't do anything but talk. Talk about new ideas. What's the newest thing? What's news? What's the newest thing to talk about? Right? And we'll debate about it, and we'll tell you how wrong you are. This is what this place was about. Highly educated, had to be invited. Paul was invited, and so he got to speak. In verse 22, "Paul then stood up at the meeting of the Areopagus and said, 'Men of Athens, I see that in every way you are very religious.'" Isn't that a good thing, to be religious? No, it's not really a spiritual word. It's just you do the same things over and over and over again in a religious fashion. And you do things to appease the unseen world. You combine that, that's religious. "You're very religious. For as I walked around and observed your objects of worship, I even found an altar with this inscription, 'To an unknown God.'" We want to make sure all the bases are covered. So we got this one that represents the God that we don't even know and never even heard of. "To the unknown God." He says, "Now what you worship is something unknown. I am going to proclaim to you." Good news. I'm going to tell you about this unknown God. Verse 24. "The God who made this world," God who made the world, "and everything in it is the Lord of heaven and earth and does not live in temples built by hands." What? Where does he get his mail? If he doesn't live in a temple, where does he get his mail? How do you go in front of him? God's not there. He's not in a temple. All those beautiful, beautiful temples you saw in that picture, they were built by human hands, and some of them that were architectural wonders. They're still studying the physics of how they made the steps slope a little bit so they looked like they were level from a distance. I mean, they were just amazing, amazing buildings. They were built by human hands. He said, "By the way, the God who made everything doesn't live in a temple." What about the one in Jerusalem? Doesn't God live there? Remember the woman at the well, the Samaritan woman, and the big debate about where do we worship God? Do we worship here at Mount Horeb or in Jerusalem? And he says, time's coming when it's not going to be here or there, right? It's not a matter of where you worship, because God is spirit. And he desires people to worship in spirit and in truth, not a location, not in a building. Well, can you imagine looking around going, well, then why did we waste all that time? Wow. He says, verse 25, "And he is not served by human hands as if he needed anything." Think about that for a second. What does God need from you? Well, according to Paul, the answer is Nothing. God doesn't need anything. Are you sure, God? I mean, I'm having a moving sale. Anything you need? Huh. God doesn't need, by definition, God doesn't need anything. It says here, he says, because he himself gives all men life and breath and everything else. Yeah, what are you going to give somebody who does that? God doesn't need anything, and God doesn't live in a temple made by human hands, and God doesn't live here on the corner of 98th and Palmaris, even though he does pick up his mail here. No, he doesn't. He doesn't. And you don't come into the presence of God here, because that implies when you leave the presence of God. Can you leave the presence of God? No. And what can you give him? What can you do? Let's make a deal, God. I'll give you 10% of my money. Yeah. You give God a dollar, he'll give you 10. You ever heard that? Let's make a deal. Let's make a deal, God. I'll come to church. In return, I expect from you are you into making deals with God? Does God need anything? Does God live in temples made in human hands? No. Is this a new thought? Yes, this is a new thought for them. This is. As they look around at all the objects of worship and all the things that they've done and created and all the routines and the rituals and the religious stuff they do in order to appease the god or goddess in this, because you know who's the patron goddess of Athens? Athena. Right? That big temple, that was Athena's temple. Let's make a deal with Athena. Let's make a deal with Apollo. Let's make a deal with Zeus. Let's make a deal with the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Let's make a deal. It says here, from one man he made every nation of men, that they should inhabit the whole earth. And he determined the time set for them and the exact places where they should live. And God did this so that men would seek him and perhaps reach out for him and find him, though he's not far from each of us. For in him we live and move and have our very being. As some of your own poets have said, we are his children. We live and move and have our very being in God. And he does all this so you should seek him. Look for him. Find him. The one who gives you life. The giver of life. The giver of meaning. The giver. Reach out. But you've got to go all the way to Athens to do it. No, I mean Jerusalem. You need to go all the way to Jerusalem. No, I mean Rome. You need to go all the way to... No, I mean... Wow. In him, you move and live and have your very being. Yeah. And if you haven't figured out that he doesn't need anything, then you're going to keep playing, let's make a deal. And you know what's going to happen? This isn't going to mean much to you. It's just not going to mean much to you. And you're not going to feel loved. You're going to want to know why God didn't keep his end of the deal. Why your children got sick. Why the person you loved was in a car accident. Why your body is failing and you're going to want to know, God, what's the deal? I thought we had a little contract. And you're going to miss all of it. All of the love, all of the grace, all of the peace, all of the joy, all of the patience, the kindness and the goodness and the gentleness and the faithfulness and the self-control. You're going to miss it all. You've got to get past that. It says, therefore, since we are God's children, we should not think that the divine being is like gold or silver or stone, an image made by man's design and skill. Yeah, what does your God look like? Well, he looks like me. Looks like us. No. No. In the past, God overlooked such ignorance. But now he commands all people everywhere to repent, for he has set a date when he will judge the world with justice by the man he has appointed. Whoa, the man he has appointed. Guess who he's talking about? Jesus. He says he has given proof of this to all men by raising him from the dead. How did he prove that this man was going to judge the world? That God knows what it's like to be human? That God knows? He raised him from the dead. We celebrate that every week. We celebrate it. We celebrate every day, hopefully. Right? That God knows what it's like to be me because he lived in the flesh. Now, Paul's doing great. He's got their attention. These are new thoughts. Until he hits the word resurrection. Yeah. And then he slams into a wall. It says here, when they heard about the resurrection of the dead, some of them sneered. Okay. I hope you guys have been practicing your sneering. We've seen it. We've seen the Pharisees sneer at Jesus, right? We've seen sneering going on. They couldn't handle this idea of resurrection. What is that about? Okay, here's the deal. Your Greek philosophy, the basis of some of your philosophy, goes all the way back to Aristotle, Plato, Socrates, right? And the Platonic thought. I don't know if you've ever studied that kind of stuff, but here's the premise. There is spiritual and there is material. The two will never, ever, 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 ever meet. Yeah. The whole idea of beauty. There is something in the ethereal realms that is the ultimate table. Everything here is just a poor copy of that design. Beauty. There is the ultimate beauty there. Everything here is a poor copy of that design. So you would not want to go from the material world to the spiritual world back to the material world. That would just be stupid. Okay, oversimplification, but you got the idea, right? The idea that the divine became physical. And if that's true and died, would the divine stay spiritual or physical? Yeah. Does Jesus have a body? Does he still have a body? Paul believes so. He says, when you die, you're going to be like Jesus. We don't know what that looks like. We don't know what that's like, but you're going to be like Jesus. But if you can't get past the divine becoming physical, you're stuck. You're stuck. And what we're talking about short-circuited everything that they've been using as a base for their disputes and discussions and their education. And so the result was sneering. Sneering. You know, every week we do something Jesus asked us to do. Remember the body. Remember the blood. This is my body. This is my blood. Yeah. The divine became material. And they couldn't get past that. So let's see what happens. It says here, others said, "We want to hear you again on the subject." At that, Paul left the council. A few men became followers of Paul and believed. Among them was Dionysius, a member of the Areopagus, also a woman named Demarius, and a number of others. So Paul did convince some people about Jesus. And if you turn your Bible over to the book of First Athens, you'll see some things about this church. Now, we don't have that one. We don't have that book. Don't know how it went from there. Don't know. All I do know is Paul leaves there before Silas and Timothy get there, and he goes to Corinth, and boy, we get to talk about Corinth next week, and you don't want to miss that because it's a wild place. It's a really wild place. And to prove it, they've got two of the longest letters in the New Testament because even the church is still seriously messed up. And we're going to talk about why. Why that's such a wild place. But you know, in 1 Corinthians, Paul said, you know, not many of you were wise. Not many of you were educated. Not many of you had knowledge. For God chose the people without wisdom and knowledge to present Jesus. There's something about people who think themselves wise that make it hard for them to become believers. Why? Because God gets it wrong sometimes, right? I mean, according to them. And who knows what's right? Well, they do. Yeah, the wise. That's who he was talking to in the Areopagus. Didn't get to finish the sermon. Didn't get to do it. Got stuck at the resurrection. What do we do without the resurrection? Where is your faith without the resurrection? It's philosophical. Yeah. It's the resurrection we believe in. It's the resurrection that we stand on. Paul wrote that amazing chapter of 1 Corinthians chapter 15 to that church that is not educated because he needed to remind them to stand on the resurrection. It's about the resurrection. It's about the resurrection. Yeah. We're going to remember. We're going to remember that God so loved the world that he sent his only begotten Son who became flesh, lived for a while among us. And then laid down that life for us. And it may not fit in your philosophy. And you may have to change your worldview. But if he was raised from the dead, then he is who he says he is. And we have the hope that we have. So this morning, we're going to take a little bit of bread. little bit. And we're going to remember as we feel it, as we taste it, as we smell it, even though it doesn't smell much. Yeah. As we chew it, as we swallow it, Jesus had a body. And then we're going to take a little bit of juice, and we're going to remember that Jesus had life blood. Yeah. And all week long, we're going to remember. And all week long, even though we're not here, we're going to live a life that is a worship, acknowledging that God is God and we're not. All week long, our hope is going to be in what Jesus did for us. Yeah. It's okay to say, hey, I'm not with those who are too smart, too educated to believe in the resurrection of Jesus. That's what my hope is in. The one who gave us life and everything.